The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories. From World War II...
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
...to the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
Our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Dick Camp. He served this nation in uniform in Vietnam and really for 26 years. He's the author of a number of books because he's also an accomplished Marine Corps historian. One that we'll be talking about a little bit later in this episode is Assault from the Sky, U.S. Marine Corps Helicopter Operations in Vietnam. Dick, it's an honor to have you with us.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, tell our listeners where you grew up and how you got interested in joining the service.
All right. I was born in Newark, New York, upper New York State. My father was a state trooper, and my mother, of course, was a homemaker. I think I, from my first recollections, I always wanted to be a Marine. And fortunately, my parents insisted that I go to college first. Once I graduated, I signed up, went to Officer's Candidate School at Quantico, Virginia, for 3 months, and then 6 months at the basic school, and was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps.
And when was this?
This was 1965.
Okay, so at this point, we're past Gulf of Tonkin, and so
right. You
have a pretty good idea of what's going on in the world. What were your expectations upon your commission?
Well, I went infantry. I always thought that the Marine Corps was all infantry. I didn't realize there were other MOSs, but I wanted to go infantry, and I received that MOS, Military Occupational Specialty. My first duty station was the 4th Marine Regiment in Kaneohe Bay, Hawaii. Somebody's got to do it. As a rifle platoon commander, I spent a year as a platoon commander and then as a year as a reconnaissance platoon commander. And then I received orders to Washington, D.C. at the Marine Barracks, where I was a special ceremonial platoon commander. And after 2 years, I received orders to go to South Vietnam.
Were you training for anything in particular? Obviously, ground combat in Vietnam, but given the somewhat tropical climate in Hawaii, tropical climate in Vietnam, was that an ideal spot to prepare?
You know, looking back, it probably was because of the high humidity in Hawaii and the heat. But nothing really prepares you or prepared me for the heat and humidity that you get in Vietnam. We left the United States and stateside utilities, which were heavily starched, flew over commercial, really a nice way to go to war. When they opened the cabin door at Da Nang in South Vietnam and that heat and humidity hit us, all of a sudden you start sweating and the starch from my utilities started running down my arms and legs. Welcome to Vietnam.
Wow.
Uncomfortable.
So a little bit of an acclimation process then, I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely. But there really wasn't an acclimation process. I went immediately to the field after about 3 days in country. And so either you were in good shape or you weren't going to make it.
Did you get used to it at some point?
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, it was funny because we always used to smile and say you could tell how many days a man had been in the field by the sweat rings underneath his arms on his utilities, all white.
What kind of temperatures were typical?
Well, I think in the high 90s with high humidity, probably 80% or so. At some times it got to be pretty close to 100. It was really hot and humid.
In addition to obviously the energy, the impact on your stamina. What else, what other challenges did the conditions?
Well, they were shooting at you. that was a tough thing to get over.
Obviously that, but just the climate before we get to the, okay. The combat. Yeah.
You know, as an infantryman, a grunt, that's what they used to call us, a grunt in Vietnam. You know, you lived in the field, and so you got dirty and filthy, and you smelled, and your clothing was never washed. I mean, you might spend 10 days, 2 weeks in the field, and you can imagine what you smelled like and felt like after all that time.
So where did they put your unit into circulation?
My company was located on the hill positions near Quezon. This was before the siege. I joined them. I flew to Quezon, which was the main base, by helicopter. Another helicopter took me out to the hill positions, and I joined the company as it sat on this hill, and that was my first introduction to Vietnam.
And how long were you there before the real action began?
Well, how about the next day? patrol came up from the hills, or from a valley. Actually, it was a gulch. And the lieutenant who was leading patrol said, "Skipper," and that's what a Marine captain was called, Skipper, "I smell gooks, and I see gooks, what I think are tracks in the stream bed." So that night was okay. The next day I went out with this patrol, platoon-sized patrol, about 20-some-odd men. And we went down these steep gulches into this stream bed. And I got real nervous because the stream bed was only about 5 feet wide, but it was as straight as an arrow for about 50 meters. And I thought, boy, if they've got a gun in there, we're gonna really be in tough straits. I always kid because where is the best location for the unit leader? I mean, where can you best control your unit? And unfortunately, being the new captain, I got too close to the point man being the first man of patrol. And he came to a stream bed, and there were a branch. One went forward and one went to the left. And I motioned for him to go to the left, and I didn't take my position again. So I was about three men back from the lead man. And as I happened to glance up, all of a sudden I saw him do kind of a double take and fall back against the bank and start shooting full automatic. And before I could even react, I'm the new guy. My reactions aren't well developed yet. Somebody had taken me, threw me against the bank, and was pulling a pin from a hand grenade. And so that was my first experience in the field 2 days after I arrived.
What did that do to you?
Well, it taught me a lot of things. First of all, Captain, be where you're supposed to be. Get out of the way of the troops. They're the ones that know what they're doing. And number two, it really showed me that you got to be up on the step. You know, you can't be just moping along. You've got to be thinking about what's going on. What are you going to do? What happens if your unit gets shot at? And how are you going to maneuver against who's ever shooting at you?
When you talk about being on these streams and the banks that go on for a while, one of the things we hear about a lot in Vietnam is the fact that the foliage really helped to obscure the enemy, and they could be a couple of feet away from you and not even really know it. How big of a problem was that for you?
Oh, absolutely. The North Vietnamese were past masters at camouflaging their positions. In fact, this position that I just talked about, the point walked right by and a bunker embrasure, which was 3 feet from them. And fortunately, nobody was home. If anybody had been home, we'd have been all killed, no question about it. But they are experts at camouflage. In fact, the North Vietnamese would allow your unit to walk into their prepared lines of fire, open up, knock your point down, and then the unit leader has a decision to make. Does he send more people out to get the casualties? Or does he pull back and call in supporting arms? Whichever way it goes, it's going to be tough on those lead men that were hurt.
Clearly the case. So what were the best ways to counteract that? What strategies did you come up with for that?
Try to find them before they opened fire. Yeah, I mean, you got to be very, very careful. You know, you chose your lead men so that they knew what the heck they were doing. They were experienced. Maybe they even smell the North Vietnamese. North Vietnamese smelled like wood smoke and fish. And so you smell that. I've done it several times. In fact, I was like Pavlov's dog. Hair stands up on your arms. Hair stands up under your helmet. I mean, your senses are so alert to this that, I mean, it really, really caused a physical reaction.
How close do you have to be before that smell comes?
Very close. Too close, actually. For example, I was leading a nighttime. My company was going out at night, and it was dark as pitch, and literally you almost had to hang on to the man in front of you. And we went through a grove of bamboo, thick grove of bamboo on this road, and all of a sudden, before my reactions could really tell me what was going on, I smelled him. And you instantly kind of suck in your breath, and you tighten up because you know they're there. And it wasn't but about 2 or 3 minutes later that the lead element stepped on some booby traps that they had just emplaced. So I lost some people there.
You mentioned before that officers have a decision to make.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go send in support immediately, or do you wait for it? What was your strategy most of the time?
Well, after getting down out of the line of fire, it depends on the terrain and situation. That's a heck of an answer, but that's really what it is.
Sure.
I mean, every element of that contact is different, and so sometimes you may want to, if you're far enough away and nobody's been hurt, you may want to call in supporting arms right away, artillery, mortars, air support, whatever. If you've got some casualties out there, can you call in weapons that aren't going to hit your own casualties but yet may give you an opportunity to keep the enemy's heads down so you can recover them? Really, a hell of a decision to make.
Absolutely. How fast could you get that support if you called it in based on where you were at that point?
Well, artillery is pretty fast if you call it in. And of course, sometimes you're within the mortar fan. 60-millimeter mortar, company commander carried those. Those are the company commander's supporting arms. And other times you might want to call in air support. For example, one of my lead elements got shot at one day, and my forward air controller, who is a PFC, if you can imagine that, he said, "Skipper, you want some air?" And I said, "Hell yes, I want air." And I'll tell you, within 5 minutes, there was an aerial observer over my head. It was the fastest I've ever seen. Just one of the luck of the draw.
Amazing. Dick, we're going to take a short break right now. When we come back, we'll pick up and talk about more of your combat experience in Vietnam. A little bit later in this episode, we'll talk about one of your many successful books on Marine Corps history, Assault from the Sky, looking at helicopter operations in Vietnam.
Right.
This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. We'll be right back.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiadin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. We're joined today by retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Dick Camp. He's been explaining to us about his combat experience in Vietnam. And Colonel, let's just pick up, I guess, where we left off. After those initial weeks, how did that change your leadership style, your frame of reference heading into some of the bigger operations? At that point, you probably didn't know you were headed into.
Well, you know, first of all, I eased into it because there were no really large engagements during my first 3 or 4 months in country, which helped me get my feet on the ground, establish my standard operating procedures for the company, get to know the troops, they got to know me, and so you feel comfortable with leading Marines in combat. Now, certainly anytime you get shot at is a whole new experience, but at least you've started feeling comfortable. You had situational awareness. What could happen? What's going to happen? How are you going to react to it? That sort of thing.
How long does it generally take to build up an instinct, or, for lack of a better word?
Hard to say, but I would think that, you know, you need about 30 days or so to really get your feet on the ground and feel comfortable with the situation, not only the leading Marines, but also the area that you're working with and the enemy that you're working against.
What was the general mindset from you and your superiors at that point? In 1967, what was the attitude?
Yeah, that's a good question also. Let me tell you this. That as an infantryman, you don't care about the big picture. You don't care whether the president thinks you should be there or not be there. You don't care whether the people at home think you should be there or not there. All you care about is what's 1,000 meters to your front, that what could kill you. You don't care about the politics of the war, because all you're interested in is doing the best job you can so that your troops survive to go home.
So once you were there for 3 months, now we're looking at some major combat operations. How did that first one unfold?
Well, we were operating just below the demilitarized zone in what came to be known as the Leatherneck Square area. Our battalion went out, and there are 4 companies in a battalion, and we relieved a company that had 3 companies. And I don't think the North Vietnamese realized that all of a sudden there was a beefed-up battalion out there. And late in the afternoon, we got hit. One of the companies got caught out in the middle of a rice paddy and really took some heavy casualties. And the North Vietnamese actually came in and penetrated the battalion position. They got inside the position and into the battalion 81-millimeter mortar positions and were actually shooting Marines in their pits. So it was touch and go for a while. My company at the time was escorting Rough Riders from Khe Sanh to Dong Ha. So I joined the next morning. And when I joined them, all they could tell me was, wait outside on this road and we'll send a detail up to pick you up and lead you back to the battalion position. When I got out there, we got off the trucks, and I had well over 200 men in my company at that time because we were taking out some replacements. They hit us with 38 rounds of incoming artillery, and I lost 20 men in the space of about not more than a minute and a half. They never adjusted an inch on the artillery. When I joined the battalion, we went back in. Finally, they shut off the artillery. I remember the battalion commander calling a meeting of his company commanders, and I went up to where he was. And this is in a scrub growth area of, again, in the demilitarized zone. And there was a mound of equipment that must have been 10 feet high and 20 feet in diameter of helmets, packs, flak jackets, bloody bandages. And these were the casualties that they had suffered a few hours before I got there. It was just unbelievable. So all of a sudden you go from, here we come, we're going to help the battalion out, to you're right into it. That night we got hit with our own artillery. The company on my right flank took a Marine, was killed in action. And the next morning, the real fight started, because I went up to join a company that just had its lead element shot down. I came up on its flank with 2 tanks to try and take some of the pressure off, and they hit us. There was a rice paddy to our right flank that was overgrown and everything, and it stood up. There was a battalion of North Vietnamese in the rice paddy that started running right in towards the battalion. Now, we had them on the long flank. We had them on the axis with our tanks. And I remember the tank gunner with his 50 caliber and the cupola opening fire. He got about 12 rounds off, and both tanks exploded. They hit them with multiple rocket-propelled grenades. So now we're well into it. And then from that time, which was probably early afternoon to about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, we were fighting for our lives. We had, I think, 54 Marines killed in action and 400 wounded. And there was only about 700 of us out there. So you can see the tremendous casualties that we took.
How did you react to that sort of loss?
For me personally, I hadn't eaten in about 2 days. I hadn't slept probably 2 or 3 hours in all those 2 days. And so you can imagine what your body is experiencing. Plus the adrenaline pumping through constantly. I was utterly exhausted. And I will tell you that my emotions were on my sleeve, because we were trying to evacuate. Marines had been killed in action, and that was very tough. But we finally walked out of there. And I can remember, we were the last company to come out, of seeing friends of mine who were sitting on the sides of the road. Of course, we're all spread out, and looking at them, saying, "My God, you survived." And that was the way you felt at that particular time.
Wow. Dick, we'll pause for another break here. We'll come back and have our final segment with Dick Camp, retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel. This is Veterans Chronicles.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Veterans Center. This is Veterans Chronicles.
Welcome back. This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus, joined today by retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Dick Camp. And Colonel, you were just relaying the very gripping story of the major combat about 3 months into your tour. Relay to our audience what you discovered and just how serious that was.
Well, it was very serious because there were two companies. The North Vietnamese had split the battalions. They had two companies on one hill and with a battalion command post, and then two companies on another hill. We were within supporting range, but still they had segmented the battalion and then hit us. Years later at a reunion, we ran into an Army aerial observer who had flown over the battlefield during the fight itself, and he said that there were literally hundreds of North Vietnamese running towards our positions. They had 12.7 anti-aircraft guns around us, and when we called fixed wing in, they were really blasting away. In fact, they shot down an A-4 right over the top of us. I could see the pilot coming out of the cockpit. Fortunately, they were able to rescue him. So it was really bad. We had one artillery battalion battery firing for us that supposedly fired 10,000 rounds of 105 millimeter ammunition for us that night, plus all the fixed wing that we called in, A4s, F4s, and so on. And we had two AC-130 or AC-47 gunships with their miniguns expend their entire load of ammunition, and I believe they carried something like a 250,000 rounds of 7.62. So it was a tremendous fight, one that, to be honest with you, I never thought I would survive.
Let's move to the siege of Khe Sanh. How much further down the road was this?
It started, I went on R&R to Hawaii to meet my wife at the time, and when I came back, I found out that instead of being in the demilitarized zone where we'd had that terrific fight, we were going to Khe Sanh. I thought, wow, okay, finally get out of that mess. Got up at Khe Sanh, and we ran patrols. This is in December of 1967. We ran patrols along the ridgeline, and didn't find much. When I came back, the company was. They told me to go down in the valleys. So I went down the valley and ran into big, huge bunker complexes. Fortunately, nobody was there, and we found out later, really, that the North Vietnamese had dug these bunker complexes around Khe Sanh, so that when the siege started, all they had to do was move their troops in from Laos, get into bunker complexes, and they were all set to close the ring around us. So on the 21st of January, we had above-ground bunkers at the time, with sandbags. And it was a beautiful night. The plateau area at Khe Sanh was really pretty. It was cool. Moon was out. It was one of those nights where you're just sitting around with your company command group shooting the bull. And as we're doing this, all of a sudden I heard off in the distance, boom, 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 boom. And that's incoming artillery. And I recognized it right away. And I will tell you that I'm proud of myself that I was the first man in the bottom of the trench of all those veterans. And they piled in on top of me. I lost two men that night. One was killed in action. One took a piece of shrapnel in his eye. But that started the siege. And the siege lasted for 77 days from January through May. And during that time, the North Vietnamese had the place surrounded. 6,000 Marines, there were a few Army, few Navy, few Air Force there as support units, and an Arvin Ranger Battalion. So you had about 6,000 people up there. It's estimated that we were invested by about 20 to 24,000 North Vietnamese, supported with artillery, and that started. The highest number of rounds that we received in the combat base from the North Vietnamese was something like 1,500 rounds of mixed artillery, mortar, and rocket fire.
What was the American strategy in response?
Kill them. Absolutely. I mean, that
was
the strategy. I believe that Westmoreland decided that the base would be held to have the North Vietnamese come in, and they would enter our fields of fire, and then we would destroy them with our supporting arms, primarily air. As the figures that I have is that they averaged, this is an average of over 77 days, that there were 300 flights of fixed wing every day. And they were stacked up, the aircraft were stacked up to 20 and 30,000 feet, waiting to come in to bomb because it was such a small airspace they couldn't get in everybody in all at once. And they averaged 9 arc light strikes a day. Now, an arc light strike is anywhere from 6 to 9 B-52s. And those B-52 bombers, I think, carried upwards of 200 or 300 500-pound bombs. And there was more ordnance dropped at Quezon than there was in 2 years in the Pacific Theater in World War II.
Wow.
In 77 days. From about 2,000 meters outside the combat base to the Laotian border, which is about 10 miles, triple canopy jungle in the valleys. And when the siege ended, there was not a tree standing. There was not a piece of ground that didn't have a bomb crater or a shell hole. So if you invite the United States to your war party, you better be ready for a brawl. It's estimated that the North Vietnamese lost somewhere around 20,000. There's no way to tell because they're still quiet about it.
At what point did you know they were about to break?
I didn't. I received orders in the last part of May, just before the siege ended, to report to the division commander, and I was going to be his aide-de-camp. And so I left just before the siege ended. But I don't think anybody really realized that they had left until the air cavalry, the 1st Air Cavalry Army, came up to support us, that all of a sudden we found out the North Vietnamese had really pulled back.
Let's talk about your new role. You led us into it perfectly. aide to the commanding general. Which general was that?
It was Major General Raymond G. Davis.
Oh, sure.
Probably one of the singular most heroic Marine general officers in the Marine Corps. Had the Medal of Honor, Navy Cross, Silver Star, Bronze Star, Purple Hearts. Had been a battalion commander at Guadalcanal and at Peleliu. Chosin Reservoir is where he received the Medal of Honor. He was truly a Marine Corps hero and a tremendous Marine Corps leader at the same time.
Here at the American Veterans Center, we have an annual banquet, and at each banquet, there is an award given to at least one, sometimes more than one, Korean War veteran, and the award is the Raymond G. Davis Award.
So. A tremendous officer. I mean, as a junior officer, I was a captain at the time. What a privilege it was to serve with him, not only because of who he was, but also the way he fought the North Vietnamese. And he just did a terrific job. What I learned best from him was how to influence the action. In other words, if you're involved in combat, how do you influence the action? As a company commander, of course, you influence it by your young troopers shooting, but also supporting arms, and that's how you influence the action. General Davis one time said, "Dick, tell me, how much is enough artillery?" And I said, "Sir, I don't know." And he said, "I was on a hill in Korea, and the fog was at the base of it, and when the fog cleared off, there was probably several hundred North Koreans in the valley." He said, "I called in artillery and called it and called it, and finally the artillery regimental commander came on the line and said, 'Well, Major, how much artillery do you want?' And he says, 'When I have a constant swish over my head, when the artillery stopped, there was nothing moving in the valley.' So if you want to know how much is artillery, when you have a constant swish over your head, incoming artillery."
It's pretty specific. How long were you his aide?
I was there, his aide, for about 3 months. And then when I came back to the United States, I was teaching at the basic school. General Davis came back to be the commanding general at the education center, and I went back down to be his aide, and I stayed his aide for about a year and a half.
Now, once you were stateside, obviously you were a little more privy to the attitudes here at home. How much did that affect you or frustrate you?
Well, it's hard to say in a mixed audience. I was really upset because you can protest the war if you want to, but don't take it out on the men who are fighting it. And that's what happened, is that instead of protesting the government's policy on whether we should be in Vietnam, they took it out on the veterans. Now, fortunately, I was lucky in the sense that I was a professional, and so I went back to the military bases, so I wasn't really exposed to it. But I will tell you a little story. I was going back overseas for another tour in 1971. General Davis happened to be going back over there, and he asked me if I wanted to ride. Well, heck yes, I want to ride. He was an assistant commandant with 4 stars. So I went up to Washington to meet him, and he was sitting on a porch at the Marine Barracks, sitting on the porch with the chief of staff of the Marine Corps, and they were talking about how they were going to bring in elements of the 2nd Marine Division to protect the Capitol from its own people. I went down to the mall, and there was 500,000 protesters down at the mall. And I thought, my God, what is this country? What's going to happen to this country if this war continues?
You stayed in uniform till 1988.
Yes.
So what other responsibilities did you have?
Well, I got siphoned off into recruiting. I had 4 tours of recruiting. Great time. My first tour was 4 years at Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was right after the draft ended. Tremendous anti-war feeling out there. It was really tough recruiting. My recruiters had a tough, very difficult time recruiting. So I had 4 tours of recruiting. I was a battalion executive officer for an infantry battalion at Camp Lejeune. Went to school a couple times in between times. So really, I had a good career.
At what point did you become passionate about writing the history of various aspects of the Marine Corps, particularly in Vietnam?
Well, I wrote a book called Lima 6, a Marine Company Commander in Vietnam. I wrote it in 1989 in conjunction with a friend of mine who was really a professional author, Eric Hamill. And through Eric, I got, once I started writing and they started taking my articles, basically, first of all, it excited me. I mean, I couldn't believe that somebody was going to actually take something that I had written. When I was in college, by the way, second semester, I walked down the passageway and I met my English professor. And he said, "Oh, are you still here, Mr. Camp?" Well, I think he'd spin in his grave right now if he found out that I'd written some books. So I enjoyed it, and it keeps me off the streets.
One of the ones we've had the privilege of looking at is Assault from the Sky and how helicopter warfare really came of age in Vietnam. Was it simply obvious heading into Vietnam that this new technology was available, we were going to use it to our greatest advantage, or would it really take some ingenuity for folks to figure out exactly how to incorporate it?
Well, it's hard to say, but I do know that when the 1st Air Cavalry went into Vietnam and they had the big fight at the Uridrang Valley, I think that people looked up and said, hey, wait a minute, instead of walking the hills and humping the hills, maybe the best thing to do is to go in by helicopter where you can leap through or leap over all these jungles into a prepared landing zone and go after the enemy rather than have to fight the terrain all the time. And that's what happened. The Army went to a very high mobility concept. The Marine Corps did to a degree, but we didn't have the helicopter assets that the Army did. But we did develop a high mobility concept, particularly under General Davis.
Did the Communists match that effort, or was that a tactical advantage that we had only?
Well, I think initially we had a tactical advantage, but then as time went on, they learned how to fight against the high mobility concept. But again, if you use the tactics involved, first of all, you put in reconnaissance units, and they would determine where or where the enemy was not, find a hilltop, be able to move right into it, where the enemy is not particularly there, and bring in your artillery. And so you have artillery on a hill, then you move into another hill that can be covered by artillery. So you leapfrog around, always under the artillery fan, using your reconnaissance assets to determine where the enemy is or isn't. So I think it was great tactics.
A couple minutes left in our conversation, Colonel. One more about the helicopters, and in addition to helicopters first being introduced in a major way in Vietnam, it's also the last image we have of Vietnam with the helicopters departing from the roof of the U.S. Embassy. And you talk in the book about how that operation was orchestrating the tragedy of not being able to bring everyone we hoped to bring out. What was the takeaway there?
Well, the takeaway there was, what a tragedy. The tragedy of Vietnam. Here we are of 1975. The war for us ended really in the late 70s, and yet we're still fighting there, or still involved. And then to go in and pull out the ambassador and the final Americans out of the American embassy was just a very tragic affair as far as I was concerned. We're lucky that the North Vietnamese allowed us to leave and from Saigon.
Last question. When you look back at your time in Vietnam as a Marine, what comes to mind most? What are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of having led Marines in combat. That may sound merciless, but for a Marine officer, a company commander, to lead Marines is really the epitome, as far as I'm concerned, of being a Marine officer.
Colonel, it's an honor to have you with us. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your time today.
Hurrah, thank you.
Retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Dick Camp, accomplished military historian and author. This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. Thanks for listening.
Hurrah.
Hurrah.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center. Veterans Chronicles is available wherever you are. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles and follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.